The BizNews Power Hour.
Well, good afternoon. It's the 24th of November. That means it's Wednesday all day, almost the end of the week. Can you believe it? One more day hour of power for you. That'll be coming up tomorrow night. Remember, on this program, we have 4 days of the week that we give you the BizNews Power Hour. And then for Fine Music Radio, on a Friday, we have Carrie's Corner, where Carrie Adams talks wine. But in tonight's show, well, a bit of controversy. We're talking about Regulation 28, a lengthy discussion that I had today with Magnus Haystack, recently returned from Mauritius. And we got talking about how Mauritius works with its exchange control and whether they have anything like Reg 28. And of course, that was like a red rag to the Magnus Haystack bull. He started talking about how Reg 28, which is collusion between Treasury and the local asset management companies, where they force retirement savings in South Africa, 70% thereof, to stay in South Africa. Now, that might not be a bad idea on paper, and you might even be able to argue that because you're retiring in South Africa, you should really be building your wealth in rands. The trouble with all of this is that South African investment performance has been appalling over the last 10 years. And as a consequence of this Regulation 28, which was introduced in 2010, anybody who's put their money into retirement annuities or retirement funds and enjoyed a modest tax benefit has paid for it and then some in the underperformance of South African equities and other investments relative to those internationally. And it just doesn't make sense. Of course, there will be some eloquent arguments from local asset management companies as to why Regulation 28 is a good thing. In reality, it's a very bad thing for the retiree. And the reason for that is that the performance of the investments has been far, far greater in the 99.5% of the investment universe, which is outside of South Africa. When you have a look at it in those kind of terms, you've got to scratch your head, as Magnus Haystack does. He's one of the few voices who can actually come out and say this, because Magnus has his own business. He's an independent financial advisor. He's not linked to any asset management company. And if they tried to tell him that he should be doing this in supporting the local asset managers, he'd tell them to take a flying jump. Anyway, it's an interesting discussion, and it's very much the kind of thing that journalism is all about. Isn't that so, Justin Rowe Roberts? We are here to serve our community and try and help the globally thinking South African to prepare their own wealth basket for their own retirement.
Agreed, Alec. It's great to have guys like Magnus share his opinion. And when his opinion is backed up by facts like it is, the 70-30 allocation towards a global investment portfolio hasn't worked since 2010. As you said, the returns in South Africa have far underperformed that of developed markets. I think the BizNews portfolio just goes to show that how exponential companies, especially in this day and age, companies that have led the technological advance that we're all benefiting from day to day, whether it's Apple or Microsoft using their products on a daily basis all over the world, and investors have benefited from that. And Magnus, being independent as he is looking out for good change, which is what it's all about.
Yeah, it is indeed. So according to Reg 28, 70% of your portfolio has to be kept in South Africa. You may only invest 30% internationally. And as a consequence of that, you've missed out, if you are going through normal retirement funds, on a very good run for international equity markets over the last 10 years. One doesn't know just what's going to happen in the next 10 years. Only the good Lord above has got any inkling about what happens in the future. But certainly, if you are restricted to 0.5% of the investable universe, it's ridiculous to think that you can perform as well as someone who's able to invest 99.5%. And actually what Magnus has done with his customers, his clients, as he said to them, don't invest in these tax benefit retirement investments, in other words, retirement annuities and so on. Don't even touch them, because the penalty that you get by investing in them, by being forced to invest in 70% in South Africa, is far greater than what you'll be gaining in taxes. So you deal in numbers all the time. That's your game. It's interesting when you sit down and put things into a spreadsheet and you start looking at the numbers, how the facts jump out at you, which are not always that easy to absorb when you're just discussing a narrative.
South Africa is such a small part of the global economy that it just makes sense to have a diversified portfolio that gets exposure to these developed markets and these good things happening all over the world.
So lots coming up on that subject with Magnus Haystack. That's after we've received the latest updates from our partners at the Financial Times of London. And then you'll be hearing from Melanie Vaness. She's the chief executive of the Pietermaritzburg Chamber of Business. It's a cracking interview. And what Melanie will tell you is that unless the government moves to punish those who caused the riots in KwaZulu-Natal and parts of Gauteng in July, business will not return to Pietermaritzburg, to the capital of KZN. It's very sobering. And then we'll be hearing from Matthew van der Walt, who's with VNL Y&R, talking to Jeremy Maggs about dark marketing, and it is as interesting as it sounds. BrightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity, and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes. And here's the headlines of the day with Nadia Swart.
The Helen Suzman Foundation, the DA and AfriForum have approached the courts to have Jacob Zuma sent back to jail, saying that there has been absolutely no indication that the former president is terminally ill, making the granting of his medical parole unlawful. The former president spent 1 month in escort prison in July, was moved to hospital in August and released on medical parole in September. The groups argued in court on Tuesday that the medical parole was granted against the recommendation of the Medical Parole Board, and Zuma's outings after being released were proof that he was fine. Zuma's lawyers called the applicants racist and right-wing. No specific ailments were mentioned, but the legal team said Zuma needs 24-hour care that he cannot get in jail. The Department of Home Affairs is fighting to stop fraud-accused Atul Gupta from attaining a South African passport, saying that allowing such would be akin to enabling him to travel and, in effect, assist him in escaping criminal prosecution in South Africa. Gupta is currently a fugitive from justice with a warrant out for his arrest. He faces charges of fraud and money laundering under the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. An application for a new South African passport was dismissed earlier this year, and Gupta's legal team has applied to have this decision overturned. Home Affairs said that fugitives have no standing to litigate in the country's courts. With councils now established in all three major metros in Gauteng, the DA has emerged as the biggest winner, taking leadership roles in Johannesburg, Tshwane, and Ekurhuleni. However, the victory comes with a caveat that the roles come as a result of smaller political parties with no formal coalition agreements in place. The party will need to lobby smaller players to pass important things like budgets and policies, and this could result in very volatile governance over the next 5 years. The ANC, meanwhile, has been left licking its wounds with reports of infighting and turmoil within its ranks in Gauteng. And now it's back to my colleague Justin for the market report.
Thanks, Nods. The JSE All Share Index was slightly lower at 70,700. ₹15.92 to the dollar, ₹21.26 to the pound, and ₹17.84 to the euro. Gold is lower at $1,782 an ounce. Kruger Rand will cost you around 30,000 Rand. Brent crude is trading at $82 a barrel, and Bitcoin is flat, trading at around the 900,000 Rand level. In the financial news, furniture and appliance retailer Lewis Group says high levels of inventory are helping to offset global supply chain challenges, with merchandise sales rising by more than a fifth in its half year to end September. The group's good stock position is in a competitive advantage going into Black Friday and the festive season, South Africa's largest furniture chain, said on Wednesday, as it increased its half-year dividend by 46% to 2 rand per share, about 130 million rand payout. Merchandise sales increased by 21% to 2 billion rand to end September, whilst operating profit rose 24% to 340 million, with collections improving despite pressure on consumers.
This daily market report was made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Today is Wednesday, November 24th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Today, we'll pick apart the Biden administration's announcement that it will release crude oil from America's reserves.
Some people have described it as the strategic political reserve as opposed to the strategic petroleum reserve.
Our U.S. energy editor, Derek Brower, explains how the move might have backfired. An FT video journalist and producer, Donnell Newkirk, will talk about his documentary on the music business and how artists navigate the changing industry landscape. I'm Joanna Gao, in for Mark Filipino, and here's the news you need. Yesterday, the U.S. government said it will authorize the release of 50 million barrels of crude oil from the country's Strategic Petroleum Reserve, or SPR. That's the equivalent of about 2.5 days' worth of U.S. oil consumption. The White House said that the goal is to bring down fuel prices, but oil prices actually ended up higher. The FT's U.S. energy editor, Derek Brower, says commodities markets knew this was coming and weren't impressed.
All in all, the market looked at this and thought, that's not a huge amount compared to what we were expecting. And anyway, in a couple of weeks' time, OPEC, which the U.S. administration has been asking to increase supply, may decide to do the opposite, may withhold some planned increases, or may even cut, some analysts believe. And so when you factor all those things in, the impact on prices was not quite what the administration hoped. Prices have risen, not come down.
So, Derek, is this a blunder on the part of the White House? Did it miscalculate the oil market?
Some analysts say that the administration just isn't very well equipped to handle the nuances of the oil market. I think that may be a bit unfair. It has lots of very bright people working in it. I think actually it's working just fine for the administration in terms of what the administration wanted to do with an SPR release, which is signal to Americans who are about to drive home for the Thanksgiving holiday to see their mother-in-law, to signal to them that they were acting to try to drive down petrol prices, gasoline prices. Even if it doesn't work, they can now blame OPEC and Saudi Arabia and Russia. And for the U.S. administration, that's important because inflation across the economy is such a huge drain on President Biden's popularity at the moment.
So it sounds like more of a political move then.
Yeah, some people have described it as the strategic political reserve as opposed to the strategic petroleum reserve, this reserve that the White House announced yesterday it was going to tap and release oil from. And some other people have described it as a symbolic move.
The U.S. is actually coordinating this oil release with several other big countries, including the U.K., also China. How common is this?
Well, this is really interesting as well, because the last time that the U.S. got involved in a coordinated release was in 2011, when there was a civil war in Libya, which is a big oil producer, and Libya's oil production was pretty much shut off. So that was a genuine oil supply emergency, and oil prices were heading, you know, north of $120. Today, there is no real emergency in terms of supply. In fact, supply is increasing around the world. What there is a political emergency for President Biden about inflation in the U.S. So the International Energy Agency in the past would coordinate these emergency releases. This time the IEA was not involved in coordinating this, and some IEA members like Germany were quite hostile to the idea of using emergency reserves of petroleum that are there for supply disruptions like hurricanes or civil wars.
Derek Brower is the FT's U.S. energy editor. The way we listen to music is so different than it used to be. It's largely because of technology. People have so many ways to listen to music now, and artists have new ways to make a living. FT video producer Donnell Newkirk documented the journey of his own cousin, the artist producer Dirty Blonde. Donnell dropped the video on our website earlier this year.
This film is about the evolution of the music business. The industry has gone digital, with streaming now reigning supreme.
Donnell told us what inspired him to make the film.
Watching my cousin, Dirty Blonde, watching him in at the beginning of his journey, I just wanted to document everything and really show an insider's perspective of the music industry in 2020 and beyond, the current music industry. I've seen other documentary films. I was really inspired by Hoop Dreams and The Last Dance, Michael Jordan's Last Dance. So I just wanted to show what the music industry was from the inside.
My name is Dirty Blonde. I'm a recording artist and record producer. I'm from upstate New York. I've been trying to make it in the industry for about 2 years now.
We grew up in the church, our grandparents, so we're all pretty musically inclined, singing in the choir, playing instruments. He played the drums since he was like a toddler. And so when he started making music, it was kind of just a natural transition. As with, I think, every artist, you know, they start out with that dream of getting a record deal and making it big, but you have to adjust. It's not easy to get a record deal. It's not easy to get yourself out there as an artist. As you see in the documentary, at 300 records, trying out, performing for a record label, playing his, all his music, singing his heart out, giving it all he had. Essentially a tryout for the record label, and they gave him his feedback, and then they'll see if they want to work with him or not, based on his music and his character and things like that, his charisma. So yeah, we've seen it all. He's went from record label meetings to independent platforms and releasing music online, things like that. Watching him adjust and finding platforms to where you can put your music out there independently, and then marketing himself on social media and things like that. He's just had to adjust and go with, you know, what the trends are and to stay relevant.
Before COVID happened, I was about to do a festival, but because of the virus, it got shut down. So now I'm doing a virtual live performance with eMusic Live. It's just a new way of entertainment. It's a new way of revenue too, as an artist, you know?
It's not just artists. Record labels have had a huge adjustment as well. Labels once dominated the industry, and a lot of people would say they exploited artists with terrible contracts. Donnell interviewed several record label executives for his documentary.
What's the right choice for an artist? Kind of up for the artist to decide, right? I think today artists probably have more choices, and so it's hard, whereas in the past it was simple. You really had one path, which was through a major record label.
And I believe that artists should do whatever deal is best for them. Some artists don't need a lot of money. They need guidance.
Because the labels are so flush with cash right now from streaming, as they compete with each other for talent, they're also driving up the price of signing talent. All that means that artists are really in a better position to negotiate contracts, and they can now command bigger advances, better terms, like higher royalty rates, or even ownership of their masters. So the label is just acting as a distributor.
Some artists don't need the label. You can blow up on TikTok, you can distribute your music independently, and therefore you automatically own your masters and you own the majority share in the royalties. So you're getting all your money back. You're not splitting it with anyone besides the rest of your team. But labels are great for some artists. They are still very powerful. They still have a great marketing teams that can really help you focus. They help you to get sync licensing and sponsorships and things like that. So they do serve a purpose for some artists, but every artist just has to really look at their situation and see what works best for them and what's most important for them.
I've learned that it's not just about music, it's about business too. As an artist, you are the business. Like Jay-Z said, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. It's different ways to make money, I think, as a smaller artist, you know. It's about the hustle.
You can watch the entire documentary on FT.com. We'll have a link in the show notes. Special thanks to FT video producer Donnell Newkirk, to Jess Smith for producing this piece, and to Breen Turner for mixing it. And a musical note before we go about Radiohead, one of the earliest bands to leverage technology. The English rock band streamed the release of the album Kid A more than 20 years ago. That's prehistoric in internet time. In 2007, they made the album In Rainbows available as a pay-what-you-want digital purchase. And
This month, the bands released an interactive exhibition timed to the reissue of Kid A and Amnesiac. It's downloadable on computers and video game platforms. Radiohead produced a psychedelic experience together with Epic Games, the developer behind the wildly successful game Fortnite. You can read more on all of these stories at FT.com. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. We'll be off for the next 2 days for the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday, but make sure you check back next week for the latest business news. The FT News Briefing is produced by Fiona Simon and Mark Filippino. Our editor is Jess Smith. I'm Joanna Gao, and I've been hosting for Mark this week. We also had help from Peter Barber, Gavin Cullman, and Michael Bruning. Our global head of audio is Cheryl Brumley, and our theme song is by Metaphor Music.
How does business empower our nation? By bringing produce to our tables, giving us technology that connects us, hospitals that care for us, and the tools that shape our cities. And by backing the next generation of business owners. That's why South Africa banks on business. Business banks on us. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized financial services and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Magnus Haystick, back home after a sojourn in Mauritius. Good break?
No, Alec, I haven't been there in 2 years as a result of the lockdown. And I was so impressed with what I saw. New roads, new shopping centers. There's just so much development going on in Mauritius. It was very good to see.
And very safe.
Extremely safe. You just don't, you're not worried. I mean, we South Africans walk around locking our car doors and the Mauritians just look at you and they say, what's the problem? And we realize we're living in an unnatural society in many ways. And they are just so relaxed. There's just no crime, no murders. There's no physical assaults. There's no hijackings. It's a normal society, in other words.
Do they have exchange control there? And I'm asking this because I've been going through quite a lot of a family member's financial affairs. And the more I look at it, the more I get angry about this Regulation 28, which has forced South Africans to keep 70% of their retirement assets in South Africa, because it actually just makes you go backwards continuously. Do they have that in Mauritius, anything like this Reg 28?
No, they don't. They have total freedom with what you can do with your money, what you like, and no questions asked. They do ask questions about money laundering, no question about that. But once they're happy that it's legitimate money, they say, where do you want it, sir? What currency do you want? And how soon can we do it for you? It is such a pleasure. You know, again, that's a normal society. We are so used to dealing with the rules and regulations of exchange control. You know, it's embedded in our banking system. It's embedded in our lives. They don't have Regulation 28. And the point you're making is that the media and the investment community at large, the investors themselves, are now starting to say, we're not making money with our pensions. We're now talking about 7 years, almost 10 years, that our REC 28 funds barely have beaten the current inflation rate in South Africa, and in some cases have actually not made a cent. Now, that is not good, and people are realizing that there's a big train smash coming. And it goes back to that Regulation 2010 that says only 30% offshore. And as a result of two things, the rest of the world has had a fantastic economic growth period, and we've had a terrible period. And we've become poor. Our pensions have actually losing money in real terms year after year after year. And people should be made aware of this. And the industry is very, very quiet about this. Not a peep about Reg 28 or any amendments to
Why?
Reg 28.
Why are they quiet? Just unpack that for us. And first of all, how Reg 28 came in and why the industry is not screaming about it, because it's their clients who are getting poorer.
Well, they're starting to see that. We noticed yesterday Coronation reported its results. For the seventh year in a row, Coronation's assets under management have actually declined. So there's been no real growth for Coronation. And you'll see the same, I bet, at Alexander Forbes, Alan Gray, and Ford, and those big companies. our market, it's not growing, it's shrinking. But, and this is purely my own opinion, there's a very nice arrangement between the asset management industry and Treasury as to protect the industry from outflows, because you will have outflows. And that keeps the money in South Africa, but ultimately it's not their money, it's the investors' money, and they should have a say in the situation. And the late Alan Greenblow and I often spoke about this. It's quite a shocking situation where billions of rands flow towards the asset management company, and you and I and other members of pension funds, whether individually or collectively, have very, very little input as to what happens with your money. It's a question of send us your money, we know better, and you must be happy with what you've got. And that situation is starting to become a big factor. And more and more, I sent you an email as one example of someone who said, hey, what's happening? My projected numbers have been declining over 4 years. It's coming down and down and down and down. At least he has somebody who's taking interest in his pension funds. A lot of people don't take, they don't care. They shove it in the bottom drawer, thinking that one day, you know, there'll be some money for them. And in fact, the reality is that their purchasing power or their future purchasing power is being eroded at an enormous rate as we speak.
Yeah, this inability to take responsibility for your own financial affairs is probably at the root of it. But I guess it's only when you open that bottom drawer after how many years that you realize the marketing, the messages that you've been given are not actually the truth. Because you're not retiring, your pension has not grown because you've been forced to keep 70% of it in South Africa, and South Africa's economy has been struggling for at least 10 years, let alone just the last, the last seven. But Magnus, let's just go back a little bit in that and understand this. If you look at it from a cynical perspective, if you have to keep 70% of your retirement money in a country, then that means that the rest of the world or the whole world's financial institutions are not competing for that money. In other words, there's a finite number of local institutions who you can go to. And that finite number means, if the one is slightly better than the other, well, so be it. But they charge you for the money that is being put with them or that they're managing for you. If there were no Regulation 28, in other words, if you were allowed to put your money anywhere, your retirement funds anywhere in the world, you would presumably be able to pick Schroders in London or a company in the United States or Australia, if you fancied that, rather than being forced to go to the South African financial institutions. And am I being too cynical here?
You're on the right track, Alec. There's a major element of that. And I'm quite sure the spokespeople of the asset management industry will come back with a very nice polished reply. But it's to a certain extent, it's true that it's a protected cartel. It's very, very well remunerated. People are making huge amounts of money. Once you're in the pension funds industry, if you take Coronation, they made a profit of 4 billion rand plus. 25% of that goes to their staff as bonuses. So it's a very, very highly and a very profitable industry. And if you still make it big, if you've got scale, I mean, that's where our few remaining millionaires and billionaires have been created in the last couple of years, is in the asset management industry. And I speak to a lot of people in the industry, the smaller players. They're battling to get size because it's a question of the big five or nothing. They're getting all the big deals. But if they had to open the doors to foreign competition, fees will fall fairly dramatically. If you look at the Vanguards and the BlackRocks, and if you see what they charge to manage money versus what our pension money companies charge, is a tremendous difference. So it is a little bit of a closed shop. And some people are benefiting, and it's most definitely not the investors who are in those funds.
So why don't the investors shout about it? Why does the industry or people, financial advisors, not say, but hang on, my clients are being prejudiced by this?
Well, again, another aspect of the industry, a lot of these big institutions, I'm not going to mention names, but you can work it out yourself. If you're an aligned advisor or broker with that company, your loyalty must be to the company or you'll get excommunicated very, very quickly. So your independent advisors out there are, to a large extent, doing this and acting in the best interest of their clients. And it's also the pension fund consultants who should be raising this issue. But this is a raging hot topic affecting millions of people. And I get so angry when I see these beautifully written articles by the insurance companies saying, you're going to be poor one day. You should be saving more. And the returns have been so poor. I mean, it is just shocking how poor the returns have been. You never have certain outlets in the media wanting to discuss this because it affects their advertising. But it's right now, it's not a great situation for a great deal of people. And this needs to be, you know, aired and discussed, and practical solutions should come forthcoming. I mean, I was very surprised that I couldn't find one journalist when the new amendments to the Regulation 28 came out about 2 weeks ago. Not one journalist made a comment about the fact that you still have a 30% cap on offshore investments. Not one. They were all talking about the infrastructure and they're all going to pump money into infrastructure, but they were deathly quiet about the elephant in the room.
So you have raised your voice about this. Have you been penalized?
I'm independent. I don't work for any of the big companies. Fortunately, I'm the master of my own destiny, and I work with a lot of companies, and they have not put any pressure on me because I don't work for them. They know it. I know it. And the minute they start putting pressure on me or try to put pressure on me, I will stop dealing with them and I will really expose it. But that I'm different. I have a different situation. I'm very, very fortunate to be where I am. Other advisors are not so fortunate. They will join a big company, become part of the advisory brokerage team, but they will be very sure to toe the line. They will not, it'll be in breach of the employment contracts. They will not criticize their own company. So it's up to people like me and yourself and others who are prepared to get out there and say, guys, this needs to change. The pension fund industry is all in favor of the asset management industry, treasury, and then to the detriment of the poor members who think, oh, I belong to a pension fund, I'm okay. It's not okay.
So this infrastructure fund or allocation, clearly it's really just another tax on savers, on retirement savers, because the government is now working with the retirement funds to ensure that there's money that goes into infrastructure projects in a country where the track record is infrastructure is a invitation to plunder. We've seen that with Medupi. We saw that with Kusile. Where's the confidence that this is going to be different? Because it now appears as though through the amendments, it's actually going to be, you're going to be forced to put money into a potential Medupi or Kusile.
Yes, it is. It's, I think there's been a lot of horse trading behind the scenes out of the public lair between Treasury and the asset management industry about quid pro quos. If you support us on this score, we'll support you on that score. But I don't, at this point in time, I mean, might be out of line, but we're going to pump more money into construction infrastructure. And again, there are no guarantees about the safety of that money, the controls. I mean, we've been writing about this for years and years and years. Money disappears into a black hole and there's no accountability. I would be very, very worried if a great deal of my pension money goes into this much lauded infrastructure spend without someone watching over my money. And that would be a great, great danger for me, leaving my money in a big pension pot. I would rather take it out. And that's what, in many cases, we tell our clients, take your money out, pay your taxes now. And the cases that we've done that, and we're talking large numbers, the outcome 3 or 5 years down the road has been phenomenally in favor of the person who's taken the money, paid the taxes, and is now in charge of his or her own money. But again, you know, it's a very, very big industry with very sharp and clever people. And they know how to do PR. They know how to spin a story. But we get emails like that daily. Guys are saying, what can I do? My money is not growing.
So your advice for people who are getting to retirement age is actually just cash in your pension fund or whatever, pay the taxes, and then become the master of your own destiny and invest it in the way you want to invest it rather than being forced to put 70% of it into South African assets, which have, as you said earlier, have not performed for the past decade.
Equity assets in South Africa have not performed. You might say, I don't want to take the currency risk. You put it into bonds or cash. But most definitely, step number one is educate yourself about the various options. Do not take the first option given to you by these big investment companies. You have the right to take your money wherever you want to, whenever you want to, at retirement. And ironically enough, once you can get hold of your money, you can swing it into a living annuity, and you can still get up to 100% offshore allocation if that is the correct investment profile for you, strategy for you. But at least you decide where, with which company, and you can exercise some control over it. Do not leave it with these big investment companies. You're in a big pot. You're just a number. You know, that's just not the way.
And the game is against you because they are colluding amongst themselves and clearly colluding with government to promote this Regulation 28, which says, well, you're a South African, so keep 70% of your retirement money in South Africa. It's just crazy when you're talking about a country that is 0.5% of global GDP and a country that's much smaller like Mauritius. You can take that 100% offshore if you want to. All of this doesn't make sense.
In Australia, you can choose whatever asset class you want. You have your self-managed annuities or the supers, they call them. You decide what you want to put in your fund. You're an adult. You have skilled yourself. You take responsibility for your investments. And if it goes wrong, don't come to government. That's the way it should be treated. But we're being patronized by saying, we know better. You are actually a very stupid person, Mr. Hogg. We will tell you how to make money and you must shut up. But your returns have been zero in real terms for 7 years now. I would be very angry about that and start asking questions.
I wonder what the next generation is going to be doing, because when we see something like Easy Equities, where they've now got a million people, many young people who've never invested before, who are investing in equities, and many of them are doing pretty well because they're buying offshore equities and they're investing for the long term. When they get to retirement age and have a look back at the records, I wonder if they're going to buy the stories.
I don't think so. I think that the sale of discretionary or tax-driven retirement products like retirement annuities are under pressure. It's harder and harder to truthfully tell a person, you must make use of this every year after year because you get a tax break. It's not a tax break. You're getting a postponement of tax. And if you start doing some clever numbers, you'll see that that's quite true. You're just postponing the taxes. But the price that you're paying is that you're going into a captive situation. Your money is locked up in South Africa. And if you, whoever you want to believe, you know, about the next 10 years or the next 5 years, it can be another 10 years of very, very little growth. And, so you think you're getting the tax advantage, but you're paying the price in very, very substandard growth. If you'd play around with the numbers on what people have been earning in the United States and Europe and even Japan, you know, they've been earning for the last 10 to 15 years inflation plus 10, 12, 15% returns year after year. And in South Africa, you've been battling to get inflation plus 1 or plus 2. And that's what I'm saying. Most people's pension pots are not growing. And you can see it in the AUMs of the large companies like Coronation, which it's had no growth since 2014. And that's where our problem started. 2014 is when the growth numbers started diving in South Africa and have stayed below 2% for 7 years now.
Well, it's a few months since I last spoke with Melanie Vaness, the CEO of the Pietermaritzburg Chamber of Business. Those were tough times in July, Mel.
Oh, gosh, I don't care to revisit them. Thank you. Yes, they were awful. Absolutely awful.
You are having to revisit them at the moment, though, with the commission. Who is putting together this inquiry?
It's a Human Rights Commission. I hope that they'll use the information that they gather to take some action. Because I think this collective non-responsibility is totally unacceptable. You know, it wasn't a little economic glitch. It was a total and utter nightmare, and we've got to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And those that were complicit in it, they must face the full might of the law.
And do they have any teeth to force an action or reaction to what happened?
Well, I mean, I think they don't. If there's a case, they don't hesitate to take action in the interests of human rights. That's evident in the action that they took against our municipality regarding our landfill site. They did take that matter to court to ensure that something is done and that there's some sort of compliance. So I've been impressed with the action that they have taken.
Take us through what your contribution was to the inquiry. In other words, what you told them.
I got invited to come and testify, and it was a difficult engagement in the sense that I had to revisit all of that in my mind again, and had to say some things that I'm sure were probably not well received by many people in government services, but it's the truth, and I have a mandate for my members, and I needed to tell that truth. And the truth was that we found ourselves completely and utterly alone at that time. There was very, very little response in the first couple of days from SAPS being able to try. We try to raise people that we work with on a regular basis, couldn't reach people. You've heard subsequently our KZN police commissioner went on paternity leave in the middle of it. We were unable to get help on the ground. So we battled. We battled for a couple of days completely on our own, and that's unacceptable. I see subsequently there was some testimony to say that there wasn't much cooperation from the KZN SAP side when National came down. So I think there's got to be action taken. It's completely inexcusable that in a crisis like this, we find ourselves all alone.
The story the public is being told now is that the police in KwaZulu-Natal was overstretched, and that they need effectively more resources. So give us more money, we'll have more people, and then should this happen again, we'd be able to handle it differently. Do you buy it?
No. Maybe SAPs are under-resourced. Maybe it was unusual circumstances, but we didn't even see those that were on the ground responding. I mean, I don't have to defend that position. Everybody watched on TV as SAPs stood by and watched people load TVs into the boots of their cars. There were reports from the ground of SAPs saying to people, go ahead and loot. We're not going to do anything. So we were also told by SAPS members that it took everything in them to stand down. They were instructed to stand down. They weren't allowed to respond. And so that instruction had to come from somewhere. And we've got these highly paid intelligence units. Why don't they get to the bottom of it? Who was behind it? I think the businesses and the communities that live in these areas deserve to know the truth. Why was there such poor response? Why were they instructed to stand down? Why did we find ourselves completely alone? Who's actually calling the shots?
And you did mention that there wasn't that much support for National. What do you mean by that? When police came in from other parts of the country, were they not being supported by the local KwaZulu-Natal police?
Yes, I saw an interview, the former Minister of Defence saying when the army arrived here, they battled to get cooperation and information about what was happening on the ground. I mean, we were crying out for the army to come and help us. For days on end, begging for them to come. And when they arrived, you would have thought we would have been waiting with open arms to deploy them to the ground. It took so long to get people on the ground. It was so disturbing. It might have felt longer than it was because we were in the midst of it, but it was definitely days, you know, before we saw anything on the ground. And I think at the end of the day, Maritzburg, I think, got 120 soldiers and they were deployed to protect government infrastructure. It's not as if they were deployed on the ground to help the private sector. Communities stood together. Communities stood alongside each other and barricaded the path to their local supermarkets and things. Private security and community did that. SAPS came in a couple of days later. Our municipal security, we started having meetings probably on the third day. But in the beginning, you couldn't raise anybody. And it's not as if we don't speak to people on a regular basis. I mean, I speak to the brigadiers. I know who they are in charge of the various police stations locally, because when we have crime unfolding, we phone them. I have their cell phone numbers. We weren't able to get a response.
When we spoke in the heat of the battle, as it were, in July, you said that the feedback you were getting from business owners who'd had their businesses raised was that they would take the insurance money and not reopen. Have you got an update for us on what's actually happened?
There are a number that haven't, that there's been no movement on. I think they're still waiting for insurance payouts. Some, I understand, like the Edendale Mall, will build a smaller version. Others have mitigated their risks, so they've put in some of the lines of their business and moved other operations elsewhere. Some have rebuilt. Others that will rebuild will look to rebuild elsewhere in town. So I think you'll find that areas like Edendale that were particularly badly affected, those businesses will relocate elsewhere in the city, which means that all those small businesses that relied on the foot traffic from large businesses in the area will suffer. So that's the issue. Some will rebuild, like Brookside Mall. They rebuild the Checkers. They've got a tenant committed to that. But Edendale, it's not going to happen. As you drive past, you can still see a lot of the destruction. It's as it was then.
Has there been a knock-on on property prices or rentals in Pietermaritzburg? If presumably some businesses are leaving or won't be going back into business, has that affected property owners?
It hasn't yet. We haven't seen any massive change to the property market yet. On the commercial side, the commercial agents are saying that that some of their rentals, they're stepping back. You know, when they've got to do renewals, they're not getting increases. They're actually stepping back. There's a move for businesses out of the center of town, to the neighboring suburbs, where I'm assuming that they feel it's safer. Our town center's abominable. I don't know how we'll ever get that, resurrected again. We're going to try to work with the city to do some work in the very center of town to start seeing whether we can't attract people back there. But I don't think you're going to see the kind of confidence that we really need to see the reinvestment in Pietermaritzburg unless we do what I ask the politicians to do, and that is to stand with me and to say that they think what happened in July is totally and utterly unacceptable, that they welcome any investment in the city that brings jobs and economic growth, and that anybody that was complicit in that must face the full might of the law. To this day, that hasn't happened. And I don't know how you inspire confidence, re-inspire the businesses that were invested here to start off with, give them some sense that if this had happened again, they wouldn't be all alone. And it's also dealing with the trust deficit. There's a massive trust deficit, and understandably so, because we have people on, you know, that work in our factories and on our shop floors, and the feedback that's come back is very disturbing. It's things like our politicians, some of them were complicit. So they can't stand up and say that the looting was wrong. That at the time in community, while they were saying one thing to us, they were saying something else to community. So publicly, there needs to be a stand and a statement about this. What do we, as the government of this region, believe about what happened in July? If it ever had to happen again, do we have a suitable response in place? And what would we do to mitigate it? And how does government feel about the investment that currently is in the city? Because some of the stuff that was sprayed all over those walls, it makes people feel like the investment isn't welcome. And that's awful.
The voting in Pietermaritzburg, was that reflective of any consequences from the public, at least, to what happened?
Yes, I think there was a massive reaction from the public. The ANC came in just under 50%, which for this area is absolutely unheard of. We have the same mayor back again, and probably a more balanced council than we have had in the past in terms of opposition voice. We're, as you know, under administration for the second time in 10 years. We're still under administration. So we just hope that that wake up call at the polls will see everybody pulling together to get our city right. It's unacceptable. People that live here are passionate about our city. We love Pietermaritzburg. We love KwaZulu-Natal. We're proud to be the capital, but a capital shouldn't look like this. A capital should be a reflection of the whole province. And we are going to have to work very hard, and we're going to have to work together if we want to see things change.
Now, we've all heard the expression dark marketing, and as far as I'm concerned, it's associated with maybe slipping cigarettes to teenagers at parties that take place in places that we don't want to go to ourselves. But I suspect it's a whole lot more than that. And I want to introduce you to Matthew van der Valk, who's an executive creative director at the agency VMLY&R, and he has more than 15 years experience in dark marketing. Matthew, a very warm welcome to you. You know, immediately I wanted to call you Lord Voldemort, because I started, that's where we kind of placed dark marketing. But you make the point that it's not intrinsically illicit. So maybe a good starting point for our conversation is to tell me what dark marketing is. Is there a new definition?
Yeah. And, I think for me, what's really important to remember around dark marketing is that I suppose it's the term dark that kind of throws people for a spin. Mm. But it's more about the fact that it's not in the public eye. It's more personal. It's more about understanding the people that you're speaking to on a more individualistic basis. And it's trying to find new ways to communicate with people that are perhaps a little bit more relevant to consumers. Yeah. And it's about inventing media. So I think that, you know, traditionally we have TV, we have radio, we have all the above the line and below the line that we're used to kind of hearing about. But where dark marketing really starts to shine, I guess, is in the space of inventing new media. So it's about looking at the entire marketing mix. It's not just about communications. So for example, you know, we might look at distribution as a channel. And who are the different stakeholders across the distribution network for a particular brand that might be able to influence and impart some kind of marketing message on whoever the stakeholder is at that point in that purchasing journey?
If I had a rand for every time someone said to me that in order for brands to succeed, they have to be brave, I would be a very rich person and we wouldn't be doing this interview. But the reality is that creativity, you suggest, is where the magic of dark marketing lies. But it's also up to brands to be courageous, to be brave, and to break their own habit, and then for consumers to break a habit of traditional approach as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what's quite different, I think, with dark marketing is the approach to story. So with traditional marketing, we're all kind of going out into market, trying to shout the loudest and say why we're so important and why everyone should consider us. Where dark marketing is different is that it considers the story of the individuals that it aims to serve and tries to find a way for us to be part of that story. And so the creativity is slightly different. It's not about creating the next big concept. It's about saying, who are these people? How do they operate? What's important to them? What's their story? So it's a little more listening and a little less speaking. And you'd be surprised how many channels make themselves available. It's about looking at every single moment in these consumers' lives and where we can become part of their lives. One of the things at VMLY&R that we often talk about is brands that live in people's lives. So how are we becoming those brands that are more important, that have relevance in our consumers' lives? So it's a little less about kind of advertising and a little bit more about, you know, is it available in terms of the distribution? Is the product relevant? How are our consumers using our product? You know, sometimes the way that we intend our product to be used is completely different to the people actually using it. And so it's about listening to the consumer, unlocking those insights, and then leveraging them in everything that we do.
So beyond listening to the consumer, and one would assume is that's what brands and their agents should be doing anyway. It's almost marketing 101. How does a brand need to start recalibrating its approach when it comes to looking for those hidden or dark channels that we've been referring to?
I think that one of the things that we often talk about doing as kind of brand custodians, but don't actually do that well, is we say, yes, we're going to do something innovative. Yes, we're going to do a test market. Yes, we're going to try out this new way of approaching this consumer. And then we roll out our 5 million rand TV ad.
Followed shortly afterwards by a billboard. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think it's about kind of mixing up your marketing mix and trying things. What works for one brand isn't going to work for another. And, you know, it's also about fatigue. So as we're inventing new channels, it's not about just, it's not good enough to just kind of come up with new ideas for these new channels that we invent. It's about coming up with new channels consistently. Another way that we can kind of look at this is, I don't necessarily believe, particularly in dark marketing approaches, in always looking at what your competitors are doing. And I know that's a little bit controversial, but I think that there's more value in looking out of category. What can a, for example, luxury car manufacturer learn from a discount clothing retailer in terms of merchandising? What can you learn as an orange juice brand from a luxury car manufacturer? And what I mean by that is looking at the context. So if you walk into a supermarket, all the orange juices are merchandised next to each other. How are they standing out? And if you're going to buy a luxury car, all of the car dealerships are normally clustered together. So how do you stand out? How do you access the market? How do you start using these unexpected places and spaces and tactics to apply to completely different industries? And that's where it starts to become really creative and really interesting, is we almost take an approach to a car dealership in that example of merchandising as opposed to your traditional comms.
So in conclusion, give me an example of where your world of dark marketing has been successful beyond tobacco and cigarettes. What has stood out for you? What have you done that has illustrated this, this approach to branding?
I think that this has been particularly in the automotive industry, which is highly competitive. It's about, one of the kind of anecdotal examples that I use, and I won't use brand names because of NDAs, but we were tasked to kind of elicit additional test drives for a particularly car manufacturer. And so what we did was we created geofences around our competitors because we knew that the people going to test drive our competitors' cars were already in the market for a new car. And by understanding their mindset, we were able to increase our test drives by a factor of 50%. So these simple tactics, it doesn't also have to be a major campaign. It can also be tactics. And as I kind of often say, is it doesn't have to be a complete shift of your marketing. I think it's just adding it to the mix. It's about being able to look for different tactics. And I think that the last 2 years has taught us as brand custodians that, you know, none of us are excluded from regulation. We can all be regulated in the way that we, I mean, if you look at the events industry, everybody in that space has been regulated over the last 2 years. So I think it's really important to think about how our brands, our products and our services could possibly be regulated and thinking about how we might pivot.
If I've taken one word out of our conversation, Matthew, it's the word listen. I just think that everyone needs to listen a little bit more because once you listen, it's where the good, it's where the good ideas flow from.
Well, it's Wednesday and thank you for being with us today. We look forward to being back in your company. Same time, same place tomorrow. Until then, from the Biz News team, cheerio. You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at Biz News.